Now we have with us Ian Williams, who is the author of Deserter, Bush's War on Military Families, Veterans, and His Past. He's also the author of The UN for Beginners and writes about the United Nations for Alternet. His work has appeared in The Nation, Foreign Policy in Focus, and Salon. Ian, are you there?
I am indeed.
Well, thank you for joining us today. We just finished with the news, and one piece we haven't covered yet, which we were hoping you might be able to help us with, is the sudden announcement that about 3 months of records from 1972 to 1973 for the National Guard, which just happened to include records of George Bush's service or non-service, happened to be destroyed. Maybe you could give us a little history of these National Guard records.
Well, the key, the desperate urge on the part of the White House is to prove that George W. Bush actually turned up for service in the year after he left Texas and before he returned to Texas while he was supposedly reassigned to missions in Alabama so that he could campaign for a Republican senator. And the problem is that nobody in Alabama remembers him turning up. In fact, several people actively sort of remember him not turning up because they were waiting to see him. You know, obviously the son of a congressman, hotshot pilot from Texas. Right. They were sort of waiting to see him and, you know, to crack a few jars with him and see what could be done in getting influence.
Right.
Alas, none of this turned up. So the real key was the White House has claimed that there were pay records that he did turn up for duty. So it's, of course, there is no evidence whatsoever that anybody really tampered with these records, but it does seem suspicious since lots of these type of records keep disappearing. And
yeah,
these were on microfiche and were supposed to be, it was an experiment in which
experimental
transfer. I don't know whether they used a cigarette lighter in the experiment, but they disappeared, however.
Yeah, well, just back in June, the lawyer for the Associated Press, who was suing to get access to the records, reported that they had been told that the microfilm was available as recently as June 25th of this year, but the recent release says that it was 1996-97 when the microfilm was destroyed. It seems like there might be some possibility it happened a little early or a little later in time.
Well, of course, when they say, you've always got to make allowances for military and bureaucratic bumbling, so it's entirely possible that under normal circumstances, you say, hey, they lost some records, big deal, this is, you know, this is the government. There's just a sort of surprisingly high statistical correlation between George Bush's National Guard records and destruction.
Right.
It's, you know, as close as the link between smoking and cancer, at least, I would say.
Well, so this discussion, I mean, you know, it's of concern that perhaps George W. Bush was a deserter, of course, but, you know, some would argue, why does this matter? You know, this was however many years ago, just like, you know, when issues of his drug use came up, people were saying, well, that was so far back and he's a different person now. Why is it important that we continue to look at this issue?
Well, actually, I had a call today from an Air Force officer of this era who was deeply concerned on every level because the George W. Bush is dragging the military through the dirt in every way. First of all, by appearing as its commander-in-chief, which he keeps calling himself, far more so than ever Eisenhower, for example, who deserved to have that title, ever does. He appears in uniform in front of the troops at military bases and veterans gatherings far more often than the only head of state who appears as often in uniform is either Fidel Castro or, in the olden days, Saddam Hussein.
Well, that does lend some credence to some theories about fascism in our current government, I guess.
Well, my best analogy is, if you remember when he landed on the USS Abraham Lincoln on May Day last year to proclaim the end of hostilities, mission accomplished. That was 1 year and 850, 900 dead American troops ago. He This was rare because this was a May Day parade of a different kind. In Moscow, it used to be the military paraded in front of the civilian leadership. And here we had the civilian leadership of the Republic parading in front of the military. And it's sort of the sight of supreme leaders parading in front of large ranks of armed people who cheer to order is never a reassuring one.
Well, and you make the point in numerous places that I've seen that Bush, we will be talking in a moment about the fact that he's declined to speak to a convention of the NAACP this weekend. But he really doesn't shy away so much when he's got a lot more control over the crowd.
He's not happy with town hall meetings or press conferences, as we've seen. Occasionally he forgets the answers of the pre-scripted questions and he falls apart. What he would do if he got unscripted questions and hadn't been told the answers is anyone's guess.
Right.
He's not up to this degree of spontaneity. So the military, it's fine. He makes a set piece speech. They cheer because they're supposed to, because he's their commander in chief. And anyway, it's boring in the military, so the arrival of a president at least adds some interest to the day. But actually, I think I've been surprised at the degree of antipathy to him inside the military. I've had a lot of calls from fairly high ranking officers, past and present, who've expressed their distaste for the way that this draft dodger, this deserter, has skipped his duty, has sort of appropriated the military glory.
Right.
Because remember, he's also hasn't been actually very good to the actual military. He tried to halve the death grant to survivors' families. He's tried to cut off the meal allowance to make them pay for their own meals when they were in hospital. He tried to veto a measure that allowed people who are on a disability pension to also collect their retirement pension. And in every way, he's behaved like a sort of completely Scrooge-like to the actual serving soldiery. Not to mention, of course, that the current day's National Guard has to serve in Vietnam. There's no option like for him where he ticked a box saying no to overseas service.
Right.
And they've been retained in service way after they thought they were contracted to it, in a sort of backdoor conscription.
Do you really think that military families may turn against Bush in this next election?
Well, there have been not many studies have actually been done about military voting, but the few that have show that it's a lot more evenly balanced than people would think. Amongst the officers, there's a sort of a fairly recent general Republican sort of trend. But don't forget, the enlisted men are over 40% minorities, and they tend to reflect the social positions they come from. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you really think that an African American from Florida is going to vote Republican just because he's got a uniform?
Especially not after 2000.
No.
So, well, speaking of uniforms, and getting back to what you were saying earlier about how much Bush dons the uniform for public appearances. You make the point elsewhere that it seems that there's some perhaps Freudian angst around doing, you refer to Bush by a pet name his parents used, Little Guggen.
That's what his mum and dad used to call him when he was a baby. Isn't it cute?
Yes. Makes you want to just tickle his chin. But do you see, maybe you could elaborate a little bit on that. His father doesn't seem to have quite the support you might expect for all of Bush's policies, even.
Well, no, I think they're completely different. Bush came from the older, to some extent a bit harder, but the old Rockefeller Republican school. He's not, I actually have quite a lot of time for Bush Sr. in many ways. He was the one, I remember in the primary campaign, who denounced Reagan for voodoo economics.
Right.
In some ways he showed for Republicans some sort of access of honor. Remember, at the age of 18, he used his political influence to actually go and fight in World War II.
Right.
He commissioned himself. He pulled strings to get to the front faster. And then you see the change from that sense of aristocratic noblesse oblige.
Right.
Also, possibly out of shame for the fact that his father was a major collaborator with the Nazis, Bush's grandfather.
So there was a little bit of guilt there.
Yes. So he was obviously prepared to put distance. And so he went. He did that. He got medals. He was shot at. He was fired. And then his son, a sort of wannabe, who's obviously got some problems with his father. There's some sort of, you know, he's measuring himself all of the time.
Right.
In fact, one of the military people who called me today sort of suggested that, you know, it's a competition about who's got the bigger organ. I've got to be careful with you and the FCC.
Yes, you do.
and the whole thing, he went to be a jet pilot, even though he hedged his bets by making sure he wouldn't be a jet pilot in combat. And then, you know, he wanted to be president, and he's pulled that off, and he's managed to start and finish the war that his father didn't finish. And... yeah, actually, one of the few tangible reasons given for why he had such antipathy to Saddam Hussein originally was that he tried to kill my dad.
Yes, my daddy.
His dad seems to be a lot more urbane about it than he was.
So you also mentioned that perhaps part of the difference between the two comes from geographical difference.
Well, geographical and social. I mean... in the Northeast, the sort of aristocracy, these were the people who joined the war, who went and fought for the French Air Force before the First World War was actually declared by the U.S. And they finagled their way to the front line. But by the time we got down to Texas, these were people who, far from feeling that they had any obligations, thought that they had a real sense of entitlement, a doubled sense of entitlement. And if you were rich and successful, it was because God loved you and he'd given you the right family. You know, they'd chosen the right family in the womb. It was there was no sense of obligation. You just got to look at the people he was serving with in the Texas Air National Guard, which was known in the area as Air Canada.
Right.
Because it got you all the benefits of a trip north of the border with none of the climatological and political differences, drawbacks.
Well, and not to get too conspiratorial in this, but there has been some discussion in various quarters about, in the National Guard records that we have seen, a certain compatriot who was having similar troubles in the National Guard, who has since associated with numerous Saudi families, James Bath, I believe is the name.
Yes, they were all in there, and there's a very strong. This is a real old boy network in Texas, and they've all stuck together. The people he was with then, it's amazing how many of them have been promoted into cabinet rank or ambassadorial rank since then. The people who worked with him on these various campaigns, and but this cabal stuck together, and that's how they got away with it. They practically controlled the Texas Air National Guard, which had a lot of sort of independence from what you might call the Federal Air Guard.
Right.
And, well, the officer I was speaking to today was really indignant. He'd wanted to check with me, why was Bush commissioned a second lieutenant? And he said, you know, the only way you could do this is you go to officer training school, or you were in the ROTC beforehand, or if you were a flight surgeon, if you had a medical degree, because they were so desperate they'd commission you.
Right.
And I could assure him that George W. Bush was commissioned as a second lieutenant after he'd finished his basic training, with no other training whatsoever. And he said, well, that means he never took the honor oath, that he would never lie or cheat. And I said, well, you know, I actually think he would have had his fingers crossed behind his back if he'd taken that anyway.
just for security.
Yeah.
So, well, one last question. Again, we're speaking with Ian Williams, who wrote the book Deserter, Bush's War on Military Families, Veterans, and His Past, about the recent missing National Guard documents that have been in the news. But I wanted to, you talked earlier when we spoke on the phone about CNN sort of burying the story pretty quickly. I was wondering if you could tell our listeners a little bit about that.
Well, I'm still not entirely sure what happened. I've been too busy, but I went in, I recorded a piece, they were doing it as a hot news story, and then I got a message to say that it had been pulled. It was a wonderful interview, but it had been pulled because the White House had told them that everybody knew that these records had been destroyed, and they'd already said so. I haven't seen that anywhere else, and nobody else has.
Oh, hello? Well, it seems we have lost Ian. Hopefully not for anything that he was saying. So I certainly doubt it was. But let's go into some music, and either we'll get Ian back on the phone or we'll continue with more of Amandla here on KALX Berkeley.
The time that this minister in Indiana claimed that the theme song for Mr. Ed, the old television show about the talking horse, if you played the Mr. Ed theme song backwards, it said Satan is the source.
Misinformation.
Okay, I believe we have Ian back on the line. Ian, you there?
Yes, indeed.
Okay, sorry about that. So where we left off was, I believe, just discussing,
The White House and the way they spin the press. I think.
Let you finish that point. The CNN event. So you were saying something about that they don't ever directly lie, do they?
No, they're economical with the truth. They sort of tell enough of the truth to throw people off the scent, and it's really sort of sad to see how many reporters don't understand the sound of silence.
Yes.
And the classic case is when they said he had not taken drugs since 1974, and people have not really inquired about what he was doing before, apart from Ellen Thomas, who asked if he'd been sentenced to mandatory community service, and then Scott McClellan just stonewalled for a half-hour press briefing without saying yes or no, or without even promising to get the answers.
Right.
Obviously, there's a story, there's a fish there, as I think I say in the conclusion, there's a fish there, we know it's big, we know it stinks, but we don't know what species or where it is, but you can see the size of it from their evasions.
And if only we could just take that garbage bag out. So, well, thank you so much, Ian, for your patience and for your insight. We really have enjoyed hearing you talk about our leader in chief.
Well, and I would really enjoy hearing the sales figures as you all rush out and buy the book as well.
Yes, Ian Williams, author of Deserter, Bush's War on Military Families, Veterans, and His Past, and also The UN for Beginners. You can also find his work on the United Nations on Alternet, and in The Nation, Foreign Policy in Focus, and Salon. Thanks again for joining us. We'll have you back again sometime.
Great, thanks very much.
Thank you, Ian.
In the canteen down at Columbine, with the
flags they never
found,
striking
matches up at
Waco
when they
burnt it
to the ground. Without me,
Oklahoma
wasn't
possible
at all.
See my silhouette
in the Super 8,
around
grassing all.
Everything you know is wrong. There's a bus missing out.